Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Life can throw you curves, and sometimes life can engulf you with something that seems insurmountable. It is when something like that happens that a person is truly tested. Our guest today lived through just such an experience, but rather than me describing it, let me just share the first two paragraphs of the book he wrote about that experience. He says, "I'd like to ask you to imagine a normal day in your life. This morning, for instance, you probably got dressed, brushed your teeth, combed your hair. Maybe you slipped on your shoes and walked to your car, then drove to a friend's house or school or the office, just like you do every day. Now close your eyes for 30 seconds. When you open them, I want you to imagine all of that is gone. The life you were accustomed to, your daily routine, is gone. You can't go to a friend's house. You can't drive or put on your shoes or even hold a toothbrush. Life as you knew it is simply over." That book is called Life Ignited, A Hopeful Journey Sparked by Fire. It is Connor McKimmy's story and one that he's been living since he was 13 when a propane tank exploded and everything about him and his life changed in an instant, leaving him with burns over 90% of his body and with less than a 1% chance to live. But live he did, and he joins us now to share this remarkable and challenging journey. Connor McKimmy, thank you for joining us. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Mike. It's a joy to be here.
So that happened to you about, what, 15, 16 years ago? So you're now in your 20s, is that right? Late 20s?
Yeah, late 20s. It happened basically December of 2008, so end of 2008, and in the hospital up until mid-May 2009.
Wow. This book is about a journey that you never planned to take and one that was most likely more difficult than even this book lets us know. You can read this book in an afternoon, and it gives you a clear picture of what you went through, but you can't put what you went through into words. But take us back to the beginning, when this happened to you when you were 13 years old. What exactly did happen?
It's always funny reminiscing on this story because it's come a long way, right? And knowing that the end of the journey is so much more positive than how it started. But I was a typical kid like so many others, middle school kid playing sports, living his life. And at the time, you're starting to figure out who you are and where you want to go. And there was a girl that I had liked, and I thought, listen, this would be a great romantic gesture as our first like official date as more than friends to go out and roast some marshmallows, sit out by a fire, listen to music and just enjoy each other's company. And as a kid who didn't work or at the time you're like too young to work, you can't drive. It's like, what can you do? Go to the movies, go out to dinner or stuff like that. But it's like, yeah, to me, I thought it was romantic. I thought it was, the best chance to get to really know each other. And for me, I've always been a hopeless romantic, and I always am like a prepper or preparer, right? So I was like, I wanted the stage to be perfect before she showed up. So I had everything out there. I had the music, had the lights, I had, the snacks, all that good stuff. And the last thing I really needed to do was get the fire started. You don't want to start it too early or else you'll run out of logs. So I was like, all right, I know she's on her way. Let me get this going. It's something I had done with my brothers, with my dad, tons of times. And for whatever instance, this particular go, I couldn't get it to light. The logs were wet. It was windy. It was just very difficult to get lit. And as a kid, you're like rushing and rushing and rushing to try to get this done. You know that you're racing against the clock. And I didn't want to not have it ready when she got there. And as I'm hustling and moving stuff around, the next thing I know, I hit a propane tank and a gas canister into the fire, and there's just this explosion.
Yeah, this happened in Fort Mill. What year was it? 2000?
2008.
2008. I can't believe we're in the 2000s. In the book, you say you were trying to light the fire. My eyes shut, and then a bang, a force so strong it pushed me back and turned me around, a reddish-orange glow behind my clenched eyelids. I was running, and someone was screaming. And then lots of screaming and lights and sirens and chaos. That's a reflection of what happened. What was going through your mind when it happened?
I think you go into utter shock. I mean, you feel the explosion, and as I described in the book, it does make you shut your eyes. That force, you know, knocks you back a little bit, and your body naturally tenses up. And as I'm sitting there, I can just see this glow around me like you could in a well-lit room, right? You could close your eyes in a well-lit room, or, you know, outside, you still see a light around you. And that's how it was for me. I could see this red orange glow, and you know, I just took off running, basically, toward, like, my natural instincts was just to, like, run towards our house. And it wasn't that far away, but as I turned to run and you hear the explosion, that was a loud enough bang for my mom to hear, my next door neighbor to hear, and them to basically, my mom to jump out the window and start trying to pat me down, and my neighbor to come over with towels and wrap me up. And every time I've told the story, you know, it's hard to understand how long I was on fire for me, because it's just adrenaline and speed and everything else is just going. So it could have been 5 seconds, it could have been 30 seconds, it could have been 2 minutes. But when you look at the extent of the burn, you know, it was probably a lot longer than just a few seconds.
Yeah, you say when you look down after you opened your eyes after that explosion, you look down and you looked at your hands, and the skin on your hands had been burned away. Your mother, this is December, and your mother literally jumped out of a window when she heard it and saw what was happening and began to try to smother the flames. She too was burned in mm-hmm. that attempt. And people all over the neighborhood were coming to your rescue. You were fortunate, you say, in that your internal organs were not harmed. Your lungs, which could easily have been scorched mm-hmm. or burned if you had inhaled, they were okay. Your other internal organs were okay. That's unusual, right?
I think, you know, you face a situation with that extent of burns where if you were inhaling the flame or if you were under that kind of heat for a long period of time, that's where it could get affected. The biggest issue going forward, too, is the infection that will or yeah. could incur when it's that big of a burn. And again, there's things that we couldn't control or I couldn't control. And there was definitely miracles that took place. And I think for the doctors, the biggest one was the fact that for the 90% external burn, 75% being third degree, to not see the internal damage that probably should have been there was a huge step up from what they originally thought.
Yeah, we're heading into the cookout season, so this is a good story to tell because mm-hmm. this happens to people a lot when they're trying to light their barbecues or their grills, and suddenly the propane tank has been leaking and off it goes. This literally happened in an instant. It burnt your clothes off, or at least your mm-hmm. shirt off, and you say that you have a line. You were wearing flip-flops, still December. But you're a kid. Kids wear they wear shorts in December,
right?
And you have a line on your feet that was covered by the strap on the flip flop, mm-hmm. and that didn't burn away, correct?
No, it's wild when you look at the actual, you know, when I look at my body, you can see where I don't have burn marks from where I clenched up, where my arms would have clenched up mm-hmm. Underneath them, between your elbows. And then, yeah, with my left foot especially, my right foot was the last thing to be put out, so that was more burnt. But my left foot, you can see a perfect, like, rainbow. I was wearing rainbow flip-flops. Like, you can see a perfect rainbow flip-flop line on my left foot. And, again, it's weird how it all attacked, because my left hand's burned worse than my right hand, but my right foot is burned worse than my left foot. You know, it's just all a matter of how things healed. But, yeah, it's cool to see what our body can endure and then how it's able to recover and heal and, you know, transform into something that, again, probably shouldn't have been, but it recovered and it did its job.
Those are all comments from somebody who has survived this and gone mm-hmm. through everything that you've gone through. I'm sure you couldn't have said that even 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. The pain of having 90% of your body burned, with 75% of those burns being third degree, It's probably indescribable, I would think. But so must be the psychological pain. We'll talk about the period of time when you didn't know exactly what happened and when you did. But which was more painful, the physical pain or having to cope with the new you and your new reality, which was completely the opposite of everything that had come before?
It's probably always going to be the coping with the new reality. I think as an athlete or as just a person, we all feel different kinds of pain. As we get older, we feel new pain or more pain. And for me, yes, it was my scale had adjusted, you know, the normal 1 to 10 scale had definitely adjusted. But that daily pain you became used to, but it took a lot longer to come to grips with how I looked, what the potential future was going to look like. And I mean, for years, that was something that stayed with me. You know, I still have pain in my feet and in my body. I'm going to feel it for the rest of my life. We all are. But that psychological stuff was definitely the hardest.
We're going to talk about all of that as we go through this conversation with Connor McKimmy. We're going to talk about how you learn to cope, because the lessons he learned can be applied to everybody in their daily lives. You don't have to go through 90% of your body being burned. You just have to cope with your day-to-day stresses. But this can help you because he's learned a lot. He's a motivational speaker. He's a coach. He's the author of Life Ignited, A Hopeful Journey Sparked by Fire. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Connor McKimmy is our guest. He's from Fort Mill, TKK area. And when he was 13 years old, about 15, 16 years ago, he was burnt over 90% of his body in a flash fire, essentially lighting a fire pit in his backyard. So many of the things that made you, Connor, made you who you were when you were that 13-year-old boy, were instantly taken away from you that moment. And I mean in a moment. And as you write, you say, I was healthy and then I was not. I was active and then I was not. I was normal and then I was not. You say your whole world, which had been filled with light, your words, was extinguished by the igniting of a propane tank. Coping with that new reality. You were an athlete. You were a lacrosse player. That must have taken years to wrap your head around. You don't write, I don't think, about any of the mental health therapy that you may have gotten. Did you get any? Did you need any?
I would say for me, I guess it was, you know, mental health was viewed a lot differently, mm-hmm. you know, 15 years ago, even 10 years ago, even 5 years ago than it is now. And what I was going through, my injury and my recovery, I think it was hard to process the, you know, what the ultimate outcome could be. I think as a kid, you were still ambitious. You were still, you know, reluctant to accept some of the new realities. But for me, I was so blessed to have, you know, an unbelievable support system with the community back here, you know, Charlotte, Fort Mill, my parents, my brothers, my friends, my family, and all these people that never made me feel like I was going through this alone. And I think that was super important. You know, I had a team of people around me that you know, loved me and trusted, you know, who we were working with and the doctors to you know, give me some hope. And when I, you know, asked the questions like, can I go back and play sports? Can I, you know, get back to school? All these different things. It was never a no. It was, let's see what we can do. Let's see what we can, you know, try. And I know my parents, for the 3 months I was in a medically induced coma, fought so hard to keep my feet, to keep my hands, to you know, try to keep as much of me around, so when I did wake up, I could see, all right, look, I have 2 feet, I have mostly 2 hands, like, can I still do some of the things that I've always done?
That explosion took place. Your mother came out the window. She tried to put the fire out. She succeeded. Neighbors came across with a wet towel to try to keep you. I'm not sure what wet towels do to a burn victim, but evidently that was the right thing to do. And then the ambulance arrived, and you were talking to the ambulance folks when they were putting you in and asking them, I'm going to be okay, right? And that's when you stopped being conscious, I think.
Mm-hmm.
The next time you woke up was months later because they had put you into this medically induced coma. When you woke up, what was that like? Because in one instant, you are in the backyard, you're getting ready for a date. In the next instance, you wake up after 3 months. What's that like? What did you see? What did you experience?
I had no recollection that 3 months had passed. It was posters in my room and of, you know, sports teams winning the Super Bowl or the national championship that in December, you're like, well, that's February or that's January. You know, then I see these Valentine's Day balloons in my room. I'm like, are we really, you know, in February? For me, it was just like going to sleep and waking up 3 months later and now waking up, looking at my body completely covered in bandages, head to toe. I could see how thin I was and how much weight I had lost, like my legs and my arms, just how thin they were. And the most difficult part was I was still on a ventilator. So they woke me up and I couldn't talk. So I'm trying to process all of this internally while on, you know, an incredibly large amount of medication. You got pain medication, you got all sorts of different things to prevent infection. And I was trying to communicate with my parents by like spelling out words by just pointing, and they had like an alphabet and they would just go one by one. And we didn't get one word in before I started crying. And when I finally did get the ventilator off, it was asking the questions. You know, how bad is it? Why can't I move? Why am I missing a finger or two? Why do I have all these pins in my toes and fingers? And, I, as a kid, you're so ambitious to figure it out, I guess. You're not patient. There's no such thing as patience. And, it made me question the new reality. And it was tough to, the first couple of weeks, it was definitely sitting in darkness, but I knew early on that if I was going to sit and feel sorry for myself, my situation was never going to change. Like I had to actively participate in the recovery and in the change if I wanted it to happen.
Yeah, you're right that up until the accident, your life had been practically perfect, your words, and suddenly it was completely imperfect. Your story, because everybody who goes through something like this, their story is unique, but you have a lot in common with people who go through things like that. People's lives can change in an instant, in an automobile accident. You could fall off a ladder while cleaning out the gutters and become incapacitated. Of course, soldiers experience this because of their time in combat. Is that why you wrote this book and told this story? Because so many people can benefit from understanding how you learned to cope with this new reality.
Yeah, I think for me, the mission with writing the book and always telling my story is to, you know, do two things. It's to provide positivity in situations that don't always seem like they could be or should be. And the second one is a change in perspective, because I think I was gifted that with what happened to me, and not everybody has that opportunity to look at life in a different way. And to be able to share my experiences to hopefully change people's perspective from, you know, being upset with, you know, mundane things, the little inconsistencies or difficulties in our life, and look at the bigger picture. You know, when we're healthy, when we have air in our lungs, when we have family and friends and people that love us, there's so much more to look for. And again, my story is one of hope for sure, but it's not one that was done alone. And I've always wanted to be a messenger of sharing, you know, the stories that life is a shared experience. It's meant to be lived with people and it's meant to be used with people. And when you start surrounding yourself with people that are going to provide, you know, positivity, good energy, and also tell you when you're not doing the things you're supposed to be doing, then life is going to be a lot easier.
You know, they say timing is everything. You were 13 years old when this happened. 13-year-olds have dreams, no question about it, and they have plans for the future, but those plans generally change substantially between 13 and say 21 or 25. Do you think you were fortunate in a way? Had this happened earlier when you'd started your career or when you'd been well on your way to being a professional lacrosse player or a coach, which you ultimately became, that that journey would have been altered in a way that would not have been realized had it happened later in life? You had a window to adjust.
Yeah, without a doubt, I've always said that if I wasn't, a kid, maybe my reaction would have been different. I would hope that my reaction would still be one, that would be optimistic and positive. I just think that's how my parents raised us, and we've always been fighters, but as a kid, yeah, you had the opportunity to still dream, and you also had the opportunity to not process that new reality to its fullest depths. I was in the hospital for 6 months, but then I was right back at school to start the next fall. I was back playing sports. I was with, in that like safe space, that safe bubble that you have, in your hometowns or in your communities. Whereas, yeah, if this happened to me, 5 years ago and I'm in High Point, North Carolina, and I'm not with my friends and my family all the time, it would have looked a lot different. Yeah. And that's where, yeah, there's miracles that happen. There's timing, like you said, is everything. And being a rebellious young kid that most of us are, that question and want to pursue and are stubborn. I would say the stubbornness of a little kid, like, really pushed when people said, you're not gonna be able to do these things. As a kid, you're always like, why not? Why can't I? Or let me try. And that little bit of whatever you want to call it is definitely what started the ball rolling. And once I saw that I was able to do some of these things, then it was the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, right? You got the ball of momentum rolling down the hill and it just keeps going.
Your prognosis wasn't good. I mentioned at the beginning that when they put you in this medically induced coma, you had a less than 1% chance to make it to your 14th birthday, which is tragic when you think about it. But you did. You did survive, and you're in your 20s. Despite these daunting odds, you were told, even though they said, well, we'll wait and see if you can play sports again. You were kind of told by many people that you would not ever play sports again, that you would not ever walk again. You walk. You played Division I lacrosse, ultimately. You coached lacrosse. Do you think that being told you'll never do this again actually helped you in some way? Because by God, you were going to do it.
Without a doubt. I think it ties into being that kid, that's stubborn and being a kid, but you want to try to prove people wrong. But I've always been somebody that's, whether it's playing sports or just the way that I live my life, with a chip on your shoulder. And especially as an athlete, growing up as an athlete, like, I was never the biggest, fastest or strongest kid out there, but I always wanted to, give everything I had and leave it all out on the field. And I loved playing the underdog. I loved when the cards were stacked against me and trying to, prove them wrong. And this was just one instance where I had no choice. My back was against the wall. I was in the lowest point I could ever be. And I talk about it when I speak and when I, even in the book, but it's like, when you're at that lowest of points, there is really only one way to go, and that's up or it's forward. Yeah. And it started with just trying to put one foot in front of the other, literally with walking and taking it day by day and not trying to get too ahead of myself. And I had to change my mindset to stop focusing on what I lost and just try to hone in on the little success that we were having. Right. It's like taking one step for some people is nothing. We take thousands of steps a day. I think most people are trying to get into, 10,000 steps a day, whatever it is. Right. Like, taking one step was massive for me when I was in the hospital, because it wasn't something that was supposed to happen. So we take one step, and that was every ounce of energy and strength and pain resistance that I could for that day. And then tomorrow it was like, let's try to take two. And then let's try to take four, and just go further and further and further. And again, it was that shift of perspective, that shift in my mindset, to stop focusing on, look, I lost a lot. I lost the ability to do a lot of things, but let's just start building it back piece by piece.
The things that you endured, from the explosion that instantly changed everything through the physical therapy, the amputations, the disfigurement that you've experienced because you were burned on 90% of your body, those things could easily have crushed you, or anybody for that matter, not being able to come back from that. I mean, you might have lived, but you would have been unhappy, you would have been miserable. And I know you must have had some down moments through all of this, because just taking one step was an exhausting experience and a painful one at that. What would you say to somebody who may face something similar, maybe not to that degree, but something similar, that just going back to doing something simple that we all take for granted becomes a gargantuan effort? What do you say to them? How do they get themselves through that?
I think for me, something that I've always tried to live by with the process and what I've learned from it it's funny, when I got to High Point for lacrosse, there was a phrase that was thrown up on the wall that was just get better every day. And it was associated with our lacrosse team as, you know, practicing, whether it was strength, agility, you know, lacrosse aspects, getting better every day. But if you take that as a broader statement to your own life, it's not always physically, it's mentally, it's emotionally. There's little things we can do each and every day to just get a little bit better. And when we start focusing on our progress and not what we're lacking, what we don't have, or what we lost, then it's easy to want to go back and do it again the next day and the next day and the next day, because all you're focusing on is just getting a little bit better. And some days I might physically get better. I might run a little bit more. I might lift a little bit more or whatever. But it's the relationships with my friends, my family, I can get a little bit better at each day. It's my relationships with the people I work with. It's my relationship with myself, you know, which I think is something we all could get better at every single day. And when you shift your mindset from focusing on your progress and not, again, it's progress and process and not what you lost, it's like seeing the world a completely new set of eyes, right? And yeah, I had really bad days, but this was something that made the change for me to go forward.
And this is some of what you talk about with your company, which we'll talk about when we come back. Mac mentality. Mac is what people call you, because Connor McKemmy is sometimes difficult to pronounce, but he's our guest today. His book is called Life Ignited, A Hopeful Journey Sparked by Fire, and we will continue in just a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Connor McKemmy is our guest. He is the author of a book called Life Ignited, A Hopeful Journey Sparked by Fire. It's his story of being a 13-year-old kid in Fort Mill who was lighting a fire for a date in a fire pit in a December weekend or December evening, and suddenly his whole world changed in a flash of fire. You went through more than 130 surgeries, and you were put in that medically induced coma for 2 to 3 months. Was that to help you through those surgeries because of the pain?
Yeah, I think for the way they try to deal with pain management and that large extent, it's also just so you're not moving, you know, pulling at anything or disrupting the skin grafts, right? It's 90% of your body, with 75% being third degree. That's all skin that has to be replaced. And so you're basically in surgery every other day. I think for them, it's so you're not having to feel it, you're not having to go through it, you're not having to have that trauma. Whereas I wake up and I see this, you know, skeleton of what I was, but I'm wrapped head to toe in bandages and most of my skin grafts are starting to heal. I still had to get skin grafts on my legs and my feet when I was awake. But other than that, they were, you know, doing the large amount of the surgeries prior.
Let's talk about the skin grafts. We've never talked about this on this program, and I don't know anything about them. It just seems to me that if they take skin from one part of the body because you need it on another, then you have to heal in two places, and 90% of your body needs to be replaced. Where did the skin come from?
That's actually a great question. So there's this company called Genzymes, which is in Boston, or outside of Boston, and they basically take a big chunk of your skin all the way down, and they're able to grow. This is 15 years ago. So what they're able to do now is probably even crazier. But back then, 15 years ago, they were able to take a piece of my skin, bring it up to this lab in Boston, and just grow it on sheets. Now, it wasn't, our skin is 7 layers thick with an anchor, where the skin that they're growing is about 4 layers thick and doesn't have that anchor, right? It's artificial. It's for skin grafts. And that covers my arms and my legs. Because yes, if you had to go one by one, there is not enough skin to heal all that. And when you see me in person, I look like, I always say I'm like spotted. But the way they take skin grafts outside of your face, but for your body, they are able to get more skin by pulling it apart. And then it leaves these tiny little areas that have to heal in between. And obviously the skin graft has to take, and you would need, you know, most skin grafts, I think they tell you is like 40 to 60% take. So sometimes they have to go back and do it again. I was really fortunate that most of mine were like 75%, 80%. So they didn't have to go back. And when 20% isn't healed, then that naturally heals over time.
So to be clear, this is it's synthetic skin, but it's from your skin cells, so mm-hmm. there's no rejection. If it doesn't take, it simply didn't, I guess, seat. It's not getting blood supply,
right?
But it's not, you're not suffering from rejection because it's someone else's skin, like a, mm-hmm. like a transplant. Talk to me about what it's like to have to live now that most of this has healed, with skin grafts, because as you say, there's no anchor. Does that mean they can come loose, that they can lose their blood supply over time, that they can stretch to a point where they don't work? Tell me what it's like.
So with the CEAs, which is the synthetically grown skin, like the shortened form for whatever their technical term is, that was very new to them even at that time. So I ended up being down the road a test dummy to see what it can do. Clearly, we talked about it earlier. I played Division I sports. One of their biggest concerns when it came to playing sports or even just normal life was that skin wasn't going to be durable. Exactly what you're saying. If you were to bump into, you know, or, and even my early on outside of the hospital, my first year or so, if I would like walk into, you know, bump my leg into a chair or a desk or a table, whatever, like we all do every day, mm-hmm, probably multiple right. times. I know I'm super clumsy, happened to me all the time. It would open up and leave like a cut. Now it's way more, 15 years down the road, it's way more durable. But I have to take precautions. I have to make sure, you know, I'm wearing shoes that aren't going to pinch me in the wrong spots, or like I can't wear very, you know, hard leather back shoes, right? Really nice dress shoes or things like that will actually shear off the skin. Compared to you getting a blister or somebody else getting a blister, it becomes an open wound for me. And that's a whole different process when it comes to healing and recovery. So there was trial by fire, you could say, learning the do's and don'ts and what I can and can't do. But, you know, listen, it was able to withstand Division I sports. I've walked 36 holes in, you know, not falling apart at the seams playing golf. My body's been able to withstand a lot more than I think anybody thought, me especially. But I don't try to push the limits too much.
Do you think having been an athlete, because athletes have pain, they have muscle soreness, they sprain ankles, they break bones, they go through intense workouts, and, you know, your body has to recover from that. Do you think having been an athlete helped you through some of the pain that you endured during all these surgeries and the recovery period that you went through as a kid?
Yeah, I looked at the recovery process when I was healing, similar to if I had an injury in a sport, right? Like you have to give it time to heal, no matter how bad you want it to be fixed or whatever. You have to give yourself time, one, and you have to be, as I said earlier, an active participant in your recovery. You know, if you tore your, you know, a ligament, knee, Achilles, you have to rehab that. It's not just getting the surgery isn't going to fix the problem. You have to take pride in your recovery process. And I think being an athlete, it came natural.
And you talk about when you go back to lacrosse and you're on the field and you're putting all that new skin in danger. We take our skin for granted. We don't think about our skin very rarely. I mean, you might cut it, you may have an abrasion, and it hurts like heck for a while. You scrape your knee or something like that. You have new skin everywhere, and it's very tenuous. And when they do these grafts, you write, your skin hasn't stretched. So when you move, you're stretching this new skin. It's excruciating. Is that right?
Oh yeah. The most painful process part of the process was when I had to get my range of motion, you know, up to standard or up to par, to do the things that we wanted to do. So you are what normally people would be doing, you know, if you made I talk about in the book, like a T, or you make a Y for YMCA, like lifting both your hands up. Like I
Right.
couldn't lift my arms up, right? Because of the skin grafts were so tight, and you're having, it's not a muscle thing, it's a skin thing. And think about, people feel a little bit of pain when they try to like touch their toes, as you know, that like that little tightness, and that's the whole body. And we're always trying to get more and more and more. And I hated that part because it wasn't rehab, like it wasn't exercise, it wasn't something I knew. It was part of the process that was new to me, and was incredibly painful. But I again, it was like, what can I do? Listen to some music, you know, distract myself with a television show or whatever, so that like I can get through it, because I knew I had to do it.
You weren't supposed to walk again, but obviously you clearly have walked and played sports since then. But you write about the very first step you took when they tried to get you up out of that hospital bed, and you said it was the most incredible pain you had ever felt. Is that because you'd been in bed for so long? Is that because you had new skin on your feet, which had been burned away?
Yeah, it was more to do with the skin on my feet. My right foot especially is one that they tried really hard to take. My parents, again, you know, fought and fought and fought, and it's completely covered in scar. Like the bottom of my foot is basically all scarred. So when I tried to step on it, and even today, you know, it's gotten better over time, but I always tell people it's like if you put rocks in your shoes and just walked around. Like that's what it felt like, and that's what it feels like. But it was so new. I put my foot on the ground and I feel that sharpness, and I mean, it wasn't comfortable at all.
There's physical pain and there's this psychological pain, and this happened to you at a time in your life when young people are really concerned about fitting in. You're 13 years old. It's a time when you're just beginning to find yourself and figure out who you are and your place in the world. It's a time when we all want to look good and be part of a group and hang out with our friends and be normal. And you say you suddenly weren't normal. And it's a time when people are very concerned about their appearance. How did this new reality affect you? And does it still affect you today?
Early on, it affected me a lot more, because yeah, as a kid, you're always insecure, and you're going through that time in your life where our bodies are already changing in so many different ways. But I always talk about that I was able to get through that stage of my life because of the people that were around me, who didn't treat me as anybody other than Connor or myself. And I needed that more than anything, because if they walked around on eggshells around me, if they didn't give the same jokes or, you know, any of that stuff, I would have felt completely out of place. But instantly, when I got back to school, when I got surrounded by the community, everybody made me feel normal again. And it wasn't until I would go out in public in other places that people would like stop and stare or stop and ask me what happened. And then it would be like, oh, I'm burned. You know, as time went on, I became like so used to seeing who I was, and came, you know, I appreciated what my body was able to do. So I didn't look at it as, oh, I wish I didn't have this or that. It was like, look, I'm able to do these things. It was when I met random people that were like, hey, what happened to you? It's like, oh yeah, this is what happened.
You were never supposed to walk. You were certainly never supposed to play sports, but you ended up playing Division I lacrosse, which you say is like basketball, football, soccer, all rolled into one. There's a lot of running. You had to learn to walk and learn to run again. And then you ended up coaching lacrosse. And you talk about how difficult coaching was for you. Why?
As a coach, and I think of who I was, it's like you want to be an act, you want to play, like you want to be out there and help make a difference. But when you're able to see the light bulb like switch on somebody, and especially over a course of 4 years or 2 years or however long you have them, like it becomes so much more rewarding. And every win, I would say every win we had as a coach felt 10 times better than I ever, any win I had as a player, just because of the amount of time you put in. And you're not doing it, right? These kids are doing it, and they're the ones that are succeeding out there. And it's always better to watch, you know, the collective win. And it was tough.
You're in your book, you talk about how coaching took a lot out of you physically, because
physically,
on your feet and walking, and that was hard.
Every day, I think, you know, we're a morning practice team, so I'm usually in the office 4:30, 5 a.m. every day. Okay. And then you're out on the field for practice for a couple hours. Then kids want to come back and do, you know, extra work. So you're back out on the field. And it took a lot, and it was tough to keep going. But, you know, I didn't want to be slacking. I didn't want to be the reason we weren't doing what we needed to do. So I would always try to put my pride aside. But, yeah, it definitely added up over time.
So I'm really short on time, but I want to talk for a second about Mac Mentality. This is your company, and you can tell me who you work with, what kind of people you work with, and why they hire you. But there are three pillars that this company revolves around, and that the name Mac Mentality comes from. Talk about that for a second.
So Mac Mentality is motivation, attitude, and courage. And I wanted, when I branched out to do speaking and writing and all the things that we do with Mac Mentality, I wanted my message to be focused on things that we could control. Obviously, I had some, you know, experience where there was a lot of what went on that was so out of this world for me. But what I learned in my recovery process and what I've learned over the last 15 years is how important it is to focus on the things that we can control. And for me, motivation, attitude, and courage are three core pillars of stuff that we can lock into and use to help overcome adversity, to help deal with the struggles in our life. And that's what we try to promote.
Motivation, attitude, courage, Mac Mentality. Our guest, Connor McKemmie, motivational speaker, coach, author, and the owner of Mac Mentality. The book is called Life Ignited, A Hopeful Journey Sparked by Fire. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike. I appreciate you guys.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.